That's good, isn't it? To be able to declare all about the greatness of God in the midst of everything. And do you know what? The whole of our lives only makes sense in that context. And certainly what we're going to talk about this morning from here on in, it only makes sense in that context, that Jesus is King of the world, of all things. Now, he is the one. But he's the King of the world. That's the only reason any of this really makes any sense. This morning we're going to be, and I think this all links in, and I trust that we will kind of carry on there. You know, God help me to kind of pick up those things that follow on from what we've just been praying about. In fact, I'll tell you what, let me give you my two final points that you can, before we start, how about this? I can tell you what I'm going to say. What I want you to go away with from today is thinking about this, that our happiness does not depend on our circumstances. If there's anything that I want you to take away from today, there's two things. That's firstly, in fact, say it with me. I'm going to say, our happiness does not depend on circumstances. You ready? Our happiness does not depend on our circumstances. Okay. Point of one. It's going to be a short sermon, isn't it?
Well, you've told us this. Why are we going to stay around?
Yeah, that's the risk. You'll say this, then you'll just go. The second one is this. The good life is not the safe life. The good life is not the safe life. Yeah? Exactly, Joe. Exactly. Did you say that already with me? No. Yeah. Let's say it again. The good life is not the safe life. Okay, so that's easy. So there's two things that I want you to take away from today, and hopefully I won't distract from those points, but build on them as we go forward. What we're doing today is our last session on the Beatitudes in Matthew 5. We've been doing this since whenever. We've taken one at a time, whenever we started, September or something. And there's eight of them, and this is the eighth one we're doing today. And if there's any accusation, I set up the preaching schedule, and if there's any accusation that I cherry-pick the best topics, this is proof that that's not the case.
No, whatever.
You're
grieving as well, that was
fine. Yeah, I'm grieving.
Yeah, well, you did pass on me.
Alright, they're all out. Anyway, let me just read them out for us again, so we remember where we're coming from. It's Matthew 5, 1, and we're doing 1. Well, we'll start 1 to 10. Now, when he saw the crowds, he went up to the mountainside, and he sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them, saying, "Happy are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Happy are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Happy are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Happy are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Happy are those who are merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Happy are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Happy are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. Happy are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." A climax at the end, but I've got to somehow pick up. Happy are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, just a reminder, a little bit where we started, and it's particularly important to understand what's going on in this first term, is that these eight Beatitudes are not a tick list for the Christian life. They're not a tick list on how to get blessed. If you want to get blessed, these are the things you've got to tick. Actually, it's just slightly different to that, upside down to that. But it is instead a description of the kingdom and who the kingdom comes to. Now, you might say, well, that sounds a little bit similar, and in some ways it is, but it's not as well. So, for example, in this situation, what we're reading here, blessed are those who persecute us. It means that if you're persecuted, you're blessed, but it doesn't mean that if you're not persecuted, you're not blessed. Do you see what I mean? That's the importance of reading those things the right way round. Mm-hmm. So it's not a tick list on how to get blessed, and it's evident in this particular verse, but it is a description of what the kingdom is like, who it comes to. And so it tells us things like, what is the kingdom like? What is Jesus like? What does he value and cherish? as the king of the kingdom. And it also tells us, for those people who go, man, look at my circumstances around me. Look what's going on in my life. Look at the mess that's around me. Am I blessed? Am I blessed? I wouldn't be. It doesn't look like it. Jesus says, yes, you are. So those two things are what that reversal kind of helps us to see. So the kingdom, Jesus says in this, he's picking out, talking to the disciples, and he says, you know all those people around you who look like they're losers? They in fact are winners in the kingdom of God. That is great news. It's actually, you know, if we ever to read this as a tick list of how to get blessed, then we start to treat it as a kind of a new law, you know, a new achievement in order to attain blessing. Actually, the whole point is it's completely the opposite to that. The point is you can't achieve it. Actually, you find yourself in a state where you do receive it. Grace comes before any demands, any expectations of what we are about to do. So here we are in our verse. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. This is the only one of the Beatitudes that gets a bit of commentary on it, a bit of expansion. And it tells us actually a little bit of how Jesus uses them as application in their lives. And so he goes on to verses 10 and 11. So notice it says, blessed are those, it's out there, it's kind of third party. And then he goes, blessed, and he takes that, blessed are those who are persecuted, and then he goes, and blessed are you. Remember, he's talking to his disciples. Blessed are you when people insult you. It's cheery, isn't it? Blessed are you when people persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad. I think they feel like that at that moment. Because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So blessed are those who are persecuted, and then blessed are you. So he's taken this general principle of the kingdom, and then he's looking at his disciples and said, this is going to be true for you. Now actually at that moment they weren't being persecuted, were they? They were quite comfortable on the hillside listening to Jesus overlooking Galilee or something. And they weren't being. Were they still being blessed? Yes, they were blessed in that moment. They were talking to Jesus, that's got to be a blessed kind of place to be. But actually Jesus knew where things were going. And many of you know that all of the 12 disciples apart from one possibly met with an unnatural death, shall we say. The only one who didn't is John, who may not have done his John, but he was imprisoned on the Isle of Patmos and as a very old man probably died there. But everything, all the others were going to end up with an untimely death at the hands of others. So Jesus had in mind, in fact we go to Revelation, and the picture of Revelation is that, if you remember, the martyrs, it's almost like the people who are closest to the throne are the people who've suffered the most. If you kind of notice that, that's a crucial picture actually for Revelation, because it's written to a bunch of people who were suffering at the time. And he's saying, well, who's right at the centre? Well, it's the martyrs who are right at the centre of the throne. And so Jesus rejigging their expectations, isn't it? Calibrating it. But let's have a look at how this works. So, let me get to my... Oh yeah, let me go. Who has a good line? Oh no, I'm not going to do that. I did it before. Right. The good life is not the safe life. Well, I've made that point already. I'm making it again. We have a kind of Western need, I think, for safety and security. And particularly in a time in the world where there's lots of things that don't feel very safe or don't feel very secure, and lots of things actually way beyond our control often. But generally, we want safety and security. We want our house insured. That's a good thing. That's a good idea, by the way. I'm not saying it's a bad idea. but you can insure anything, can't you, it seems to me. You can insure for anything to protect you against risk. The possibility that something might go wrong. And so you buy something at Currys or something, you go down and you take it to the counter and they go, do you want an extended warranty? And you think, Dan says no. No, that's a no. Talk to the hand. And again, why? I've just bought this thing. It's brand new, isn't it? I mean, it's new. Well, yeah. But you never know what might go wrong in the future. Yes, it's got a 1 year warranty, but what about year two? Year three? The best thing you could do is insure it for 10 years and you've got 10 years of safety and security. And then you say, yeah, but I'm only buying an electric toothbrush. Why do I have to insure my electric toothbrush? But we kind of have an aversion, don't we, to risk. We live in a world where we can mitigate risk, we can protect against risk everywhere we turn. And if we want, we can even drive a Volvo to really mitigate any risk. Is that right? Mitigate any risk. Nice safe car, plenty of airbags, drive around in a cushion. It's really nice. So the way that you sell insurance actually is to play on fear, isn't it? That's what you do. So you go, well, look what could happen. I know Dwayne sold a travel insurance at some point, didn't you? And it didn't really suit you, did you? Because you didn't really like to play on fear, as I understand it. But you had to, the whole goal was you got to sell up as a salesman, is that right?
Yeah.
And what you got to do in order to do that is to make people feel, remind them of the absolute worst thing that could possibly happen, is that mm-hmm. fair? Let me just think what happens, you know, what if you had a heart attack, when you, how would you get it back? I was just going on a nice holiday, it was supposed to be nice. But you play, safety is the other side of fear. Fear is living as if what might happen actually does happen. This is a bit of a strange thing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So, never mind what might happen. Fear, project fear, and we respond with wanting to mitigate risk and be safe. But the reality is that the call of God upon our lives is not, I'm sorry to say, the safe life. It's not the safe life. We're called to pursue Jesus wherever he takes us. Sometimes I think we sell Christianity as an insurance policy, you know, to mitigate the risk of what might happen in the future. But I'm sorry to say that Jesus wasn't bothered about giving you a safe life. He was bothered about giving you an adventure with him. We all know that story, don't we, of Blondin? I'm sure you know it. So Blondin, in 1859, 60, something like that, he was the first person to tightrope walk across the Niagara Falls. We know what Niagara Falls is, don't we? I think the strongest, whatever, rope or something, 1,000 feet across Niagara Falls, and he was the first person to tightrope walk across this. And you can imagine the crowds that gathered to watch him do that. And he's going, you know, there's oohs and ahs from all around. He's got this big pole. There's a picture of it. If you Google it, you'll find it. I didn't put it up. But he's heading off, and first of all, he's fairly cautious. But actually, he's an absolute expert tightrope walker. And he's, in the end, kind of running across and then walking backwards and going across again and making a real show of it, and everyone's getting really excited. And then, I think it was actually other years, he came and did it again. He did other clever tricks, like he'd walk across with a wheelbarrow. Do that, and you know, then he kind of play on it. Do you think I can go across on a wheelbarrow? And go, yeah, of course you can do that, no problem at all. And the kind of climax of the story, really, to cut to the chase, is that then he goes, who wants to sit in the wheelchair, in the wheelbarrow, while I wheel it across the Niagara Falls? And all the jeering and cheering and the yeah, you can do it suddenly falls silent as everyone goes, Well, we kind of know you can do it, but actually really believing you can do it means the ability to get a safe and secure, you know, watching position, get into the wheelbarrow, and let you wheel me across. And that, I don't know whether that sounds to you a very big sales job for what it means to follow Jesus, but you know what, that's what Jesus calls us to do. He's not calling us just to say, yeah, you're great, Jesus, over there. We love the fact that you're home. He's calling us actually to get in the wheelbarrow with him and make a choice to actually really trust him with our lives. Because he's saying, blessed are you as you trust in me. The reality is we are not those people on the sidelines shouting and cheering. If you remember from Hebrews 11, I think, actually it's all the historical, great cloud of witnesses. Do you remember that? Great cloud of witnesses of all the great heroes of the faith through history, they're in the stands cheering you on. isn't it? That's what it says. You're on the pitch, as it were. You're the one being cheered on. You're not the one cheering them on. You're the one on the pitch. You're the one who's called to follow Jesus right now in your life. And there's a great cloud of witnesses cheering you on. Kind of a bit of Facebook wisdom, which I kind of like, I think, this one. Do one thing each day that scares you. You know what? Are we so safe and secure that we can't take a risk? Are we so concerned about safety and security that we miss out on the adventure that God has got for us in our lives? I hope we've instilled that in our kids, that we say, do you know what? The goal for your life is not nice house, nice job, good pension. The goal for your life is to pursue what God has called you to do, whatever the cost. To take a risk on Him and see what adventure He might have for you and what provision He might give you as a result. The good life is not the safe life. I'm sorry about that. I mean, would it be nicer? I don't know. Maybe you want a safe life. Maybe you want it tidy and safe and secure, but I'm not sure that's what it's called. In this verse, we get a kind of commentary on this, going back to the attitude and moving on. We get a kind of commentary on this, blessed are those who are persecuted, when we read the book of 1 Peter. In fact, really, it's kind of littered throughout the whole book of 1 Peter. I wonder if I just find it. As he talks to a bunch of people, a bunch of Christians, fairly new Christians, who are struggling with life. And he wants to tell them that even though it looks like maybe life's struggling, in reality they have all that they need and they are blessed. This is 1 Peter 1:6. If I can't jump in slightly before, so I'll go with this. In this you greatly rejoice, though now, for a little while. Can't jump in there. I'll have to read from 3 because otherwise it doesn't make sense. Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In His great mercy, He has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, and into an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade, kept in heaven for you. It's encouraging, isn't it? An inheritance kept in heaven for you, who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time. In this inheritance and in this shielding of God's power, salvation, in this you greatly rejoice, though even now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. These have come so that your faith of greater worth than gold may be proved genuine and may result in praise and glory and honour when Jesus Christ is revealed. All kinds of trials. I was thinking about what things are persecution and what isn't. Let me see if I can very quickly go through these. Things, according to 1 Peter, that are not persecution. Civil disobedience. If you park your car in the wrong place and it gets towed, don't call it persecution. I've just made a mistake. Disrespecting people. Those are the verses for that. If you go around offending people and they offend you back, it's not persecution, it's just, you know, what happens when you offend people. It's not disregarding relationships and responsibilities. He talks about, as a husband, look after your wife. As a wife, think about your husband. It's right to think about your relationships and responsibilities. If you give up on those and walk away from them and you have problems as a result, that's not persecution. Don't go, woe is me. It's just consequences. If you do the wrong thing, though, it talks about if you're at work and you do the wrong thing repeatedly and you get given the sack, that's not persecution. That's not victimisation. That's just a result of you doing the wrong thing. Okay, I'm just clarifying this one. Does that matter? Mm-hmm. So the fourth thing. The fifth thing is, it's not pursuing persecution. Now, we get this slight guilt, I think, in this country when we look at other Christians around the world and we go, well, we should have, it's the problem, we haven't got enough persecution. Blessed are those who are persecuted. Maybe we need more. I'm sure no one here says that, but I don't. Why have we not got much more persecution? Clear it as we read 1 Peter that persecution is a bad thing. It's not a good thing. It's an inevitable thing, but it's not a good thing. It's not something to seek or pursue.
What things do count as persecution, according to 1 Peter? Harsh and unjust treatment. So, in that instance, it's particularly talking about slaves who get beaten. And they're not deserving of that circumstance. They're not deserving of being beaten. He said that is persecution. Okay? So if he's deserved it, Peter says, yeah, there's no great value for you. But if you don't deserve it, actually that is something that you can regard as a part of a faithfulness to Jesus in the midst of your circumstances. Second thing is, not joining in. This is chapter 4. It says, look, if all around you are doing things that you know is wrong, and you decide not to get involved, and they slander you, they shout at you because of it, you know, that is persecution. Just like it says, just like these. Third thing is, when you're doing the right thing, if people have a go at you when you're doing the right thing, in our verse, blessed because for those who I won't go back to it because I've lost it now, so I won't do that. But if you're doing the right thing and people slander you or beat you or something, then that is regarded as persecution, according to 1 Peter. Malicious talk and slander. What does that mean? When people call you names, when people slander your name, say bad things about you, that is persecution, according to 1 Peter. Even when it's just doing good. I'll read it to you. This is 1 Peter 3. Finally, all of you, live in harmony with one another. Be sympathetic. Love as brothers. Be compassionate and humble. Do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult, but with blessing. Because to this you are called, so that you may inherit a blessing. I'll skip down. Who is going to harm you if you are eager to do good? But even if they do, or even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. That sounds the same, doesn't it, as that verse in the Beatitude. If you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. And the bit I missed out talks about keeping tongue from evil, not lying, turning from evil and doing good, seeking peace. All these things are about what it means to do good. And if you've found yourself being abused in some way because of that, then 1 Peter would say that's something that would be classed as persecution. And finally, because of Jesus' name. That's the more obvious one, I guess. But I'm kind of saying that because, as I read that, well, what is persecution? What counts as persecution? When people don't like me, does that count as persecution? Well, in some cases, I'm saying, yes, it does. In other cases, it doesn't. If you deserved it and you were being horrible to someone, it's not persecution. Actually, if you're doing the right thing, then it fits within. What Jesus is saying is, you are blessed. You are received something of the kingdom in the midst of it. And, yeah, lastly, because of Jesus' name. Now, I'm going to put in here a story so I don't forget to say it. A couple of weeks ago, when we were at our KST weekend, we met a guy called Milad. He lives in Derby, and he's a Syrian refugee in the UK, and he was in Syria. And he was a Christian background Syrian, a Catholic, actually. And he told us his story of what happened in Syria, in the city where he lived, and what happened, and a little bit of why he ended up in the UK. So he told us this, that the story in Syria is that there were 2.5 million Christians in Syria, which is predominantly Muslim. Right now, there are 1 million Christians. That's because some of the Christians have been killed, and many of the Christians have left the country. In his city, he didn't say which city it was. What happened was that basically ISIS rolled in and took over the city and made it extremist in its attitude towards Christianity. And he said basically they enforced the three options that are available for Christians in this within ISIS and what they wanted in this city. There were three options that they could take on. One, they could change their faith. They could become a Muslim. And that would be an option for them, according to ISIS. The second thing would be that they was that they could die. Option two. And third thing they could do is pay a fine, a kind of a tax. And as a result of this tax, you're allowed to gather and pray. You're allowed to gather and pray once a week, one day a week, and for 1 hour. So that's what the payment permitted you to do as a Christian gathering. So this is his choice, or this is the choice of Christians in that city. It's pretty severe, isn't it? Isn't that scary? Wonder what that would feel like. Three choices: convert to Islam, be killed, or pay a fee. What most of the churches did was began to pay a fee. Actually, as you can imagine, the ruling powers didn't really adhere to that and would desecrate their churches and, you know, generally make a huge mess of their places of worship, where they would even be only for 1 hour a day. Someone asked him this question. It's an interesting question. How did you feel about God in the midst of this milad? So milad's right in the midst of this situation. And actually in that city, 10 Christians were killed publicly because of that. So the threat of death, option number two, was very real. So one of the students asked Milad, you know, how did you feel? How did you feel about God? And he said, well, actually a really funny thing happened. For him, he would say, but also for many others, because the reality was that many of the Christians in the city where he lived were actually fairly nominal. In fact, they didn't really attend church very often. It was they were culturally Christian, as we would say. Yeah, that's and we said, oh, that's interesting. Okay, so there's fairly nominal Christians, just pottering along with normal life, and Syria, as we know, is a fairly wealthy country. It's not deprived in that sense. It wasn't. What effect then did on these nominal Christians? No, I'm going to. The nominal Christians with three choices as nominal Christians: die, Islam, or pay. What was the result? The result was that people began to pray more. Church attendance went up. Nominal Christians stopped being nominal and started being radical. And that was, he would say that for himself, Milad. He would say, I was nominal before, but not anymore. Not anymore. As a result of threat, Christians started returning to church. Isn't that amazing? Amazing. And someone asked him, you know, how did you cope with that? What's the, you know, what do you feel like God was saying to you that helped, enabled you to do that? And he says, as I was praying, God gave me the solution. The solution. This sounds really interesting. This sounds really helpful. What is the solution? And he said, this is the solution. Jesus said, behold, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. He said, that is the solution. Wow. Milad's family actually left the city where he was due to the persecution. They moved to somewhere else that was Damascus or something like that. And so another question came. I don't know about you, but then you go, okay, how does that work? Is it right to run? Is it right to leave? Is that the right thing to do? Or should you stay and die? What's clear is we can't judge from this side of the pond, can we? But it was really interesting. He said, well, so someone asked him this question, Milad, why did you leave? Actually, why did you leave Syria as well? But particularly, why did you leave this city where you were? And he said, well, we prayed. Oh yeah, that's clever. And that's what we felt like God was leading us to do. And he said, actually, looking back, we have now realised that was completely the wisdom of God. Okay, what happened? He said, well, from the moment that the very last Christians, so all of the Christians left the city over a period of time, the moment the very last Christian left the city, the Syrian regime invaded that particular city in order to regain control. There was a huge battle, and many people died, and actually the regime retook this particular city back from ISIS. And he said, and then actually, after the regime took over, the Christians started moving back because the regime was more amenable to Christians than ISIS. He said, that's the wisdom of God. To take the Christians out of the situation, let them fight over it.
Put them back.
So we live in a world, actually, where many people are living and dying for their faith. And we don't really feel that over here. I want to say that all these things are persecution, but clearly they're not the levels that we might face, that other Christians might face around the world. And I do not feel that that's something we should hanker after, just a suggestion. You know, let's not ask for that. But somehow in the midst of persecution, what God does is call his people up. He blesses them. And do you know what? They warrant it from God's point of view. He blesses them. He gives them the goodness of the kingdom that comes to them in that situation that is beyond something that I receive. I would suggest. That's how I would see it. And do you know what? I think that sounds like the kingdom. I think it sounds like what Jesus is saying, going, the blessing's coming to you. We find ourselves in various levels of persecution. Nothing like that. I've not been under threat of death this week that I know of. But maybe there are other things that have gone on where I've been trying to do the right thing and it's turned in my face because of the way people have treated me for that. Do you know what? I believe that in the midst of our circumstances of our life, we can find God's blessing when we find ourselves fully landed in his kingdom. And that looks like a deep joy. It's the kind of happiness, it's the kind of blessing that doesn't come from having your own way and everything going smoothly, everything looking safe and secure. It's the kind of blessing and joy and satisfaction that comes when you achieve a challenging goal, when you overcome, when you have that battle and you get to the other side and you think, yes, I did it. Yes, I did it. Do you know what? That's far more significant than that fleetingness of safety and security. I've managed just to wander through life without anything. No. There's something deeper that God's got for us. Blessing of people as we stand up for him, as we push through into all that he's got. Whatever battles might come, whatever abuse or might come, as we battle through, laying hold of that for which God's laid hold of us, with the great crowd of witnesses cheering us on, as we lay hold of that, we find right in the midst of our struggles, right in the midst of our life, the blessing of God, the deep joy of God, the provision of God. And we take encouragement. I take encouragement from the Syrian Christians. I go, wow, if you can do that, maybe I could get through another week. If you can last that, and if you can say, wow, I might die, but because of that I'm going to pray more. I'm going to put my life on the line more. Wow. And this is, by the way, what he says in 1 Peter. Look at the verse 5, 9, chapter 5, verse 9. He says exactly this. Other people around the world are having the same struggle, so keep going. Let them be an encouragement to you to not settle for the easy life and push on to the blessed life, whatever the circumstances. See, our happiness does not depend on our circumstances. Our happiness does not depend on our circumstances. And there's all sorts of things that happen in our lives. Some of those things we go, that's just persecution. Or some of those things, it's just messed up. And you go, do you know what? If people can find happiness in the midst of threat of life in Syria, you know, I can find a happiness that transcends, that goes deeper than the mess that's around in my life. Our happiness does not depend on our circumstances. And the good life is not the bad life. The good life is the adventure of God, of pursuing him, and laying hold of all he's got for our lives. Taking a risk on Jesus, getting in the wheelbarrow of Jesus and going, come on then, where are you going to take me? What is there? Let's go for that. Amen.